The sounds of battle outside were still audible, but diffuse. It was impossible to tell how close they were. "No," he said, and coughed again. I could feel his hand move toward his mouth, and I followed it with a fold of his plaid. My eyes were as accustomed to the darkness as they were likely to get, but he was still no more than a hunched black shape on the floor before me. For some things, though, touch was enough. There was little bleeding at the site of the wound, but the cloth I held to his mouth flooded my hand with sudden damp warmth. The ball had taken him through one lung at least, possibly both, and his chest was filling with blood. He could last a few hours in this condition, perhaps a day if one lung remained functional. But if the pericardium had been nicked, he would go faster. But only surgery would save him, and that of a kind I couldn't do. I could feel a warm presence behind me, and heard normal breathing as someone groped toward me. I reached back and felt my hand gripped tight. Dougal Mackenzie. He made his way up beside me and laid a hand on Rupert's supine body.
"How is it, man?" he asked softly. "Can you walk?"
My other hand still on Rupert, I could feel his head shake in answer to Dougal's question. The men in the church behind us had begun to talk among themselves in whispers. Dougal's hand pressed down on my shoulder.
"What do you need to help him? You'd wee box. Is it on the horse?"
He had risen before I could tell him that there was nothing in the box to help Rupert. A sudden loud crack from the altar stopped the whispers, and there was a quick movement all around as men snatched up the weapons they had laid down. Another crack and a ripping noise, and the oiled skin covering of the window gave way to a rush of cold, clean air and a few swirling snowflakes.
"Sassenach, Claire, are you there?"
The low voice from the window brought me to my feet in momentary forgetfulness of Rupert. "Jamie!" All around me was a collective exhalation and the clank of falling swords and targes. The new faint light from outdoors was blotted out for a moment by the bulk of Jamie's head and shoulders. He dropped down lightly from the altar, silhouetted against the open window.
"Who's here?"
he said softly, looking around.
"Dougal, is that you?" "Aye, it's me, lad. Your wife and a few more. Did you see the Sassenach bastards anywhere near outside?"
Jamie uttered a short laugh.
"Why do you think I came in through the window? There's maybe 20 of them at the foot of the hill."
Dougal made a displeased noise deep in his throat.
"The bastards that cut us off from the main troop, I'll be bound." "Just so. Ho, Mucree, Kiama Ahahu."
Recognizing a familiar voice in the midst of madness, my horse had thrust its nose up with a loud whinny of greeting.
"Hush, you wee fool," Dougal said to it violently. "Do you want the English to hear?" "I didn't suppose the English would hang him," Jamie observed mildly. "As for them telling you're here, they won't need ears if they've eyes in their heads. Lopes half mud outside and the prints of all of your feet show clear." "Mm-hmm."
Dougal cast an eye toward the window, but Jamie was already shaking his head.
"No good, Dougal. The main body's to the south, and Lord George Murray's gone to meet them. But there's a few English from the party we met still left on this side. A group of them chased me over the hill. I dodged to the side and crawled up to the church on my belly through the grass, but I'll guess they're still combing the hillside above."
He reached out a hand in my direction, and I took it. He was cold and damp from crawling through grass, but I was glad just to touch him, to have him there.
"Crawled in, eh? And how are you planning to get out again?"
Dougal asked. I could feel Jamie shrug. He tilted his head in the direction of my horse.
"I thought I might burst out and ride them down. They'll not know about the horse. That would cause enough kerfuffle maybe for Claire to slip free."
Dougal snorted.
"Aye, and they'd pick you off your horse like a ripe apple."
"It hardly matters," Jamie said dryly. "I canna see the lot of you to be slipping out quietly with no one noticing.
no matter how much fuss I made over it.
As though in confirmation of this, Rupert gave a loud groan by the wall. Dougal and I dropped onto our knees beside him at once, followed more slowly by Jamie. He wasn't dead, but wasn't doing well either. His hands were chilly, and his breathing had a wheezing, whining note to it.
"Dougal," he whispered. "I'm here, Rupert. Be still, man. You'll be all right soon."
The Mackenzie chieftain quickly pulled off his own plaid and folded it into a pillow, which he thrust beneath Rupert's head and shoulders. Raised a bit, his breathing seemed easier, but a touch below his beard showed me wet blotches on his shirt. He still had some strength. He reached out a hand and grasped Dougal's arm.
"If they'll find us anyway, give me a light," he said, gasping. "I'd see your face once more, Dougal."
Close as I was to Dougal, I felt the shock run through him at these words and their implication. His head turned sharply toward me, but of course he couldn't see my face. He muttered an order over his shoulder, and after a bit of shuffling and murmuring, someone cut loose a handful of the thatch which was twisted into a torch and lit with a spark from a flint. It burned fast, but gave enough light for me to examine Rupert while the men worked at chiselling loose a long splinter of wood from the poles of the roof to serve as a less temporary torch. He was white as a fish belly, hair matted with sweat, and a faint smear of blood still showed on the flesh of his full lower lip. Dark spots showed on the glossy black beard, but he smiled faintly at me as I bent over him to check his pulse again. Lighter, and very fast, missing beats now and then. I smoothed the hair back from his face, and he touched my hand in thanks. I felt Dougal's hand on my elbow and sat back on my heels, turning to face him. I had faced him once like this before, over the body of a man mortally wounded by a boar. He had asked me then, "Can he live?" And I saw the memory of that day cross his face. The same question stood in his eyes again, but this time in eyes glazed with fear of my answer. Rupert was his closest friend, the kinsman who rode and who fought on his right-hand side, as Ian did for Jamie. This time I didn't answer. Rupert did it for me.
"Dougal," he said,
and smiled as his friend bent anxiously over him. He closed his eyes for a moment, and breathed as deeply as he could, gathering strength for the moment.
"Dougal," he said again, opening his eyes. "Ye'll no grieve for me, man."
Dougal's face twitched in the torchlight. I could see the denial of death come to his lips, but he bit it back and forced it aside.
"I'm your chief, man," he said,
with a quivering half-smile.
"Ye'll not order me. I shall grieve ye, and I like."
He clasped Rupert's hand where it lay across his chest, and held it tightly. There was a faint wheezing chuckle from Rupert, and another coughing spell.
"Well, grieve for me, and ye will, Dougal," he said when he'd finished. "And I'm glad for it. But ye canna grieve till I be dead, can ye? I would die by your hand, more courage. Not in the hands of the strangers."
Dougal jerked, and Jamie and I exchanged appalled glances behind his back.
"Rupert,"
Dougal began helplessly, but Rupert interrupted him, clasping his hand and shaking it gently.
"You are my chief, man, and it's your duty," he whispered. "Come now. Do it now. This dying hurts me, Dougal, and I would have it over."
His eyes moved restlessly, lighting on me.
"Will you hold my hand while I go, lass?"
he asked.
"I'd like it so."
There seemed nothing else to do. Moving slowly, feeling that this was all a dream, I took the broad, black-haired hand in both of mine, pressing it as though I might force my own warmth into the cooling flesh. With a grunt, Rupert heaved himself slightly to one side and glanced up at Jamie, who sat by his head.
"She should have married me, lad, when she had the choice," he wheezed. "You're a poor weed, but do your best."
One eye squeezed shut in a massive wink.
"You're a good one for me, lad."
The black eye swiveled back to me, and a final grin spread across his face.
"Goodbye, bonnie lassie," he said softly.
Dougal's dirk took him under the breastbone, hard and straight. The burly body convulsed, turning to the side with a coughing explosion of air and blood. But the brief sound of agony came from Dougal. The Mackenzie chieftain stayed frozen for a moment, eyes shut, hands clenched on the hilt of the dirk. Then Jamie rose, took him by the shoulders, and turned him away, murmuring something in Gaelic. Jamie glanced at me, and I nodded, and held out my arms. He turned Dougal gently toward me, and I gathered him to me as we both crouched on the floor, holding him while he wept. Jamie's own face was streaked with tears, and I could hear the brief sighs and sobbing breaths of the other men. I supposed it was better they wept for Rupert than for themselves. If the English did come for us here, all of us stood to be hanged for treason. It was easier to mourn for Rupert, who was safely gone, sped on his way by the hand of a friend. They didn't come any time in the long winter night. We huddled together against one wall, under plaids and cloaks, waiting. I dozed fitfully, leaning against Jamie's shoulder, with Dougal hunched and silent on my other side. I thought that neither of them slept, but kept watch through the night, over Rupert's corpse, quiet under his own draped plaid across the church, on the other side of the abyss that separates the dead from the living. We spoke little, but I knew what they were thinking. They were wondering, as I was, whether the English troops had left, regrouping with the main army at Callender House below, or whether they still watched outside, waiting for the dawn before making a move, lest anyone in the tiny church escape under cover of darkness. The matter was settled with the coming of first light.
"Ho, the church! Come out and give yourselves up!"
The call came from the slope below in a strong English voice. There was a stir among the men in the church, and the horse, who had been dozing in his corner, snapped his head up with a startled snort at the movement nearby. Jamie and Dougal exchanged a glance, then, as though they had planned it together, rose and stood, shoulder to shoulder, before the closed door. A jerk of Jamie's head sent me to the rear of the church, back to my shelter behind the altar. Another shout from the outside was met with silence. Jamie drew the snap-hand's pistol from his belt and checked the loading of it, casually, as though there were all the time in the world. He sank to one knee and braced the pistol, pointing it at the door at the level of a man's head. Geordie and Willie guarded the window to the rear, swords and pistols to the ready. But it was likely from the front that an attack would come. The hill behind the church sloped steeply up, with barely room between the slope and the wall of the church for one man to squeeze past. I heard the squelching of footsteps approaching the door through the mud, and the faint clanking of sidearms. The sound stopped at a distance, and a voice came again, closer and louder.
"In the name of His Majesty King George, come out and surrender. We know you are there."
Jamie fired. The report inside the tiny church was deafening. It must have been sufficiently impressive from outside as well. I could hear the hasty sounds of slipping retreat accompanied by muffled curses. There was a small hole in the door made by the pistol ball. Dougal sidled up to it and peered out.
"Damn," he said under his breath. "There's a lot of them."
Jamie cast a glance at me, then set his lips and turned his attention to reloading his pistol. Clearly, the Scots had no intention of surrendering,
Just as clearly, the English had no desire to storm the church, given the easily defended entrances. They couldn't mean to starve us out. Surely the Highland army would be sending out men to search for the wounded of the battle from the night before. If they arrived before the English had opportunity to bring a cannon to bear on the church, we might be saved. Unfortunately, there was a thinker outside. The sound of footsteps came once more, and then a measured English voice full of authority.
"You have 1 minute to come out and give yourselves up," it said, "or we fire the thatch."
I glanced upward in complete horror. The walls of the church were stone, but the thatch would burn in short order, even soaked with rain and sleet, and once well caught, would send flames and smoking embers raining down to engulf us. I remembered the awful speed with which the torch of twisted reed had burned the night before. The charred remnant lay on the floor near Rupert's shrouded corpse, a grisly token in the grey dawn light.
"No!" I screamed. "Bloody bastards! This is a church! Have you never heard of sanctuary?"
"Who is that?" came the sharp voice from outside. "Is that an Englishwoman in there?"
"Yes," shouted Dougal, springing to the door. He cracked it ajar and bellowed out at the English soldiers on the hillside below.
"Yes, we hold an English lady captive. Fire the thatch and she dies with us."
There was an outbreak of voices at the bottom of the hill and a sudden shifting among the men in the church. Jamie whirled on Dougal with a scowl, saying,
"What? It's the only chance," Dougal hissed back. "Let them take her in return for our freedom. They'll not harm her if they think she's our hostage, and we'll get her back once we're free."
I came out of my hiding space and went to Jamie, gripping his sleeve.
"Do it," I said urgently. "Dougal is right. It's the only chance."
He looked down at me helplessly, rage and fear mingled on his face, and under it all, a trace of humour at the underlying irony of the situation. "I am a Sassenach, after all," I said, seeing it. He touched my face briefly with a rueful smile.
"Aye, Modunia, but you're my Sassenach."
He turned to Dougal, squaring his shoulders. He drew in a deep breath and nodded.
"All right. Tell them we took her,"
he thought quickly, rubbing one hand through his hair,
"from the Falkirk Road late yesterday."
Dougal nodded, and without waiting for more, slipped out of the church door, a white handkerchief held high overhead in a signal of truce. Jamie turned to me, frowning, glancing at the church door where the sounds of English voices were still audible, though we couldn't make out words as they talked.
"I don't know what you're to tell them, Claire. Perhaps you'd better pretend to be so shocked that you canna speak of it. It's maybe better than telling a tale, for if they should realise who you are..."
He stopped suddenly and rubbed his hand hard over his face. "If they realised who I was, it would be London and the Tower, followed quite possibly by swift execution. But while the broadsheets had made much of the Stuart witch, no one, so far as I knew, had realised or published the fact that the witch was English."
"Don't worry," I said, realising just what a silly remark this was, but unable to come up with anything better.
I laid a hand on his sleeve, feeling the swift pulse that beat in his wrist. "You'll get me back before they have a chance to realise anything. Do you think they'll take me to Callender House?" He nodded, back in control.
"Aye, I think so. If you can, try to be alone near a window just after nightfall. I'll come for you then."
There was time for no more. Dougal slipped back through the door, closing it carefully behind him.
"Done," he said, looking from me to Jamie. "We give them the woman, and we'll be allowed to leave unmolested. No pursuit. We keep the horse. We'll need it for Rupert, you see,"
he said to me, half apologetically. "It's all right," I told him. I looked at the door with its small dark spot where the bullet had passed, the same size as the hole in Rupert's side.
My mouth was dry, and I swallowed hard. I was a cuckoo's egg, about to be laid in the wrong nest. The three of us hesitated before the door, all reluctant to take the final step. "I'd better go," I said, trying hard to control my shaking voice and limbs. "I wonder what's keeping us." Jamie closed his eyes for a moment, nodded, then stepped toward me.
"I think you'd better swoon, Sassenach," he said. "It will be easier that way, maybe."
He stooped, picked me up in his arms, and carried me through the door that Dougal held open. His heart pounded beneath my ear, and I could feel the trembling in his arms as he carried me. After the stuffiness of the church, with its smells of sweat, blood, black powder, and horse manure, the cold fresh air of early morning took my breath away, and I huddled against him, shivering. His hands tightened under my knees and shoulders, hard as a promise. He would never let me go.
"God," he said once, under his breath.
And then we had reached them.
"Sharp questions," mumbled answers.
The reluctant loosening of his grip as he laid me on the ground, and then the swish of his feet going away through wet grass. I was alone, in the hands of the strangers. Chapter 44, in which quite a lot of things gang aglay. I hunched closer to the fire, holding out my hands to thaw. They were grimy from holding the reins all day, and I wondered briefly whether it was worthwhile walking the distance to the stream to wash them. Maintaining modern standards of hygiene in the absence of all forms of plumbing sometimes seemed a good deal more trouble than it was worth. No bloody wonder if people got ill and died frequently, I thought sourly. They died of simple filth and ignorance more than anything. The thought of dying in filth was sufficient to get me to my feet, tired as I was. The tiny streamlet that passed by the campsite was boggy near the edges, and my shoes sank deep into the marshy growth. Having traded dirty hands for wet feet, I slogged back to the fire to find Corporal Rowbottom waiting for me with a bowl of what he said was stew.
"The captain's compliments, mum," he said,
actually tugging his forelock as he handed me the bowl.
"And he says to tell yer as we'll be in Tavistock tomorrow. There's an inn there."
He hesitated, his round, homely, middle-aged face concerned, then added,
"The captain's apologies for the lack of accommodation, mum, but we fixed a tent for you for tonight. Snots much, but maybe you'll keep the rain off you."
"Thank the captain for me, Corporal,"
I said as graciously as I could manage. "And thank you, too," I added, with more warmth. I was entirely aware that Captain Mannering considered me a burdensome nuisance and would have taken no thought at all for my night's shelter.
The tent, a spare length of canvas draped carefully over a tree limb and pegged at both sides, was undoubtedly the sole idea of Corporal Rowbottom. The corporal went away, and I sat by myself, slowly eating scorched potatoes and stringy beef. I'd found a late patch of charlock near the stream, leaves wilting and brown around the edges, and had brought back a handful in my pocket, along with a few juniper berries picked during a stop earlier in the day. The mustard leaves were old and very bitter, but I managed to get them down by wadging them between bites of potato. I finished the meal with the juniper berries, biting each one briefly to avoid choking, and then swallowing the tough, flattened berry, seed and all. The oily burst of flavour sent fumes up the back of my throat that made my eyes water, but they did cleanse my tongue of the taste of grease and scorch, and would, with the charlock leaves, maybe be sufficient to ward off scurvy. I had had a large store of dried fiddleheads, rose hips, dried apples, and dill seeds in the larger of my two medicine chests, carefully collected as a defence against nutritional deficiency during the long winter months. I hoped Jamie was eating them. I put my head down on my knees. I didn't think anyone was looking at me, but I didn't want my face to show when I thought of Jamie. I had stayed in my pretended swoon on Falkirk Hill as long as I could, but was roused before too long by a British dragoon trying to force brandy from a pocket flask down my throat. Unsure quite what to do with me, my rescuers had taken me to Callender House and turned me over to General Hawley's staff. So far, all had gone according to plan. Within the hour, though, things had gone rather seriously awry. From sitting in an anteroom and listening to everything that was said around me, I soon learned that what I had thought was a major battle during the night had, in fact, been no more than a small skirmish between the Mackenzies and a detachment of English troops on their way to join the main body of the army. Said army was even now assembling itself to meet the expected Highland charge on Falkirk Hill. The battle I thought I had lived through had not, in fact, happened yet. General Hawley himself was overseeing this process, and as no one seemed to have any idea what ought to be done with me, I was consigned to the custody of a young private, along with a letter describing the circumstances of my rescue, and dispatched to a Colonel Campbell's temporary headquarters at Kerse. The young private, a stocky specimen named Dobbs, was distressingly zealous in his urge to perform his duty, and despite several tries along the way, I had been unable to get away from him. We had arrived in Kerse, only to find that Colonel Campbell wasn't there, but had been summoned to Livingston. "Look," I had suggested to my escorting jailer, "plainly Colonel Campbell isn't going to have time or inclination to talk to me, and there's nothing I could tell him in any case. Why don't I just find lodging in the town here until I can make some arrangement for continuing my journey to Edinburgh?" For, lacking any better idea, I had given the English basically the same story I had given to Colum Mackenzie 2 years earlier, that I was a widowed lady from Oxford, travelling to visit a relative in Scotland, when I had been set upon and abducted by Highland brigands. Private Dobbs shook his head, flushing stubbornly. He couldn't be more than 20, and he wasn't very bright, but once he got an idea in his head, he hung on to it. "We can't let you do that, Mrs. Beecham," he said, for I had used my own maiden name as an alias. "Captain Bledsoe'll have my liver for it, and I don't bring you safe to the Colonel." So to Livingston we had gone, mounted on two of the sorriest-looking nags I had ever seen. I was finally relieved of the attentions of my escort, but with no improvement in my circumstances. Instead, I found myself immured in an upper room in a house in Livingston, telling the story once again to one Colonel Gordon MacLeish Campbell, a Lowland Scot in command of one of the Elector's regiments. "Eh? I see," he said, in the sort of tone that suggested that he didn't see at all. He was a small, foxy-faced man, with balding reddish hair brushed back from his temples. He narrowed his eyes still further, glancing down at the crumpled letter on his blotter. "This is," he said, placing a pair of half-spectacles on his nose in order to peer more closely at the sheet of paper, "that one of your captors, mistress, was a Fraser clansman, very large and with red hair. Is this information correct?" "Yes," I said, wondering what he was getting at. He tilted his head so the spectacles slid down his nose, the better to fix me with a piercing stare over the tops. "The men who rescued you near Falkirk gave it as their impression that one of your captors was none other than the notorious Highland chief known as Red Jamie. Now I am aware, Mrs. Beecham, that you were distressed, shall we say." His lips pulled back from the word, but it wasn't a smile. "During the period of your captivity, and perhaps in no fit frame of mind to make close observations. But did you notice at any time whether the other men present referred to this man by name?" "They did. They called him Jamie." I couldn't imagine any harm that could be done by telling him this. The broadsheets I had seen made it abundantly clear that Jamie was a supporter of the Stuart cause. The placing of Jamie at the Battle of Falkirk was possibly of interest to the English, but could hardly incriminate him further.
"The Canner very well hang me more than once," he'd said.
Once would be more than enough. I glanced at the window. Night had fallen half an hour ago, and lanterns glowed in the street below, carried by soldiers passing to and fro. Jamie would be at Callender House, searching for the window where I should be waiting. I had the absurd certainty, all of a sudden, that he had followed me, had known somehow where I was going, and would be waiting in the street below for me to show myself. I rose abruptly and went to the window. The street below was empty, save for a seller of pickled herrings, seated on a stool with his lantern at his feet, waiting for the possibility of customers. It wasn't Jamie, of course. There was no way for him to find me. No one in the Stuart camp knew where I was. I was entirely alone. I pressed my hands hard against the glass in sudden panic, not caring that I might shatter it. "Mistress Beecham, are you well?" The colonel's voice behind me was sharp with alarm. I clamped my lips tight together to stop them shaking and took several deep breaths, clouding the glass so the street below vanished in mist. Outwardly calm, I turned back to face the colonel. "I'm quite well," I said. "If you've finished asking questions, I'd like to go now."
"Would ye? Hmm."
He looked me over with something like doubt, then shook his head decidedly.
"Ye'll stay the night here," he declared. "In the morning I shall be sending ye southward."
I felt a spasm of shock clench my insides.
"South? What the hell for?" I blurted.
His fox-fur eyebrows rose in astonishment and his mouth fell open. Then he shook himself slightly and clamped it shut, opening it only a slit to deliver himself of his next words.
"I have orders to send on any information pertaining to the Highland criminal known as Red Jamie Fraser," he said, "or any person associated with him."
"I'm not associated with him," I said.
"Unless you wanted to count marriage, of course."
Colonel Campbell was oblivious. He turned to his desk and shuffled through a stack of dispatches.
"Aye, here it is. Captain Mannering will be the officer who escorts you. He will come to fetch you here at dawn."
He rang a small silver bell shaped like a goblin, and the door opened to reveal the inquiring face of his private orderly.
"Garvey, you'll see the lady to her quarters. Lock the door."
He turned to me and bowed perfunctorily.
"I think we shall not meet again, Mrs. Beecham. I wish ye good rest and God speed."
And that was that. I didn't know quite how fast Godspeed was, but it was likely faster than Captain Mannering's detachment had ridden. The captain was in charge of a supply train of wagons bound for Lanark. After delivery of these and their drivers, he was then to proceed south with the rest of his detachment, delivering non-vital dispatches as he went. I was apparently in the category of non-urgent intelligence, for we had been more than a week on the road, and no sign of reaching whatever place I was bound for.
South? Did that mean London? I wondered, for the thousandth time.
Captain Mannering hadn't told me my final destination, but I could think of no other possibility. Lifting my head, I caught one of the dragoons across the fire staring at me. I stared flatly back at him until he flushed and dropped his eyes to the bowl in his hands. I was accustomed to such looks, though most were less bold about it. It had started from the beginning with a certain reserved embarrassment on the part of the young idiot who had taken me to Livingstone. It had taken some little time for me to realise that what caused the attitude of distant reserve on the part of the English officers wasn't suspicion, but a mixture of contempt and horror, mingled with a trace of pity and a sense of official responsibility that kept their true feelings from showing openly. I had not merely been rescued from a band of the rapacious marauding Scots. I had been delivered from a captivity during which I had spent an entire night in a single room with a number of men who were, to the certain knowledge of all right-thinking Englishmen, little more than savage beasts
guilty of rapine, robbery, and countless other such hideous crimes. Not thinkable, therefore, that a young Englishwoman had passed a night in the company of such beasts and emerged unscathed. I reflected grimly that Jamie's carrying me out in an apparent swoon might have eased matters originally, but had undoubtedly contributed to the overall impression that he, and the other assorted Scots, had been having their forcible way with me. And thanks to the detailed letter written by the captain of my original band of rescuers, everyone to whom I had later been passed on, and everyone to whom they talked, I imagined, knew about it. Schooled in Paris, I understood the mechanics of gossip very well. Corporal Rowbottom had certainly heard the stories, but continued to treat me kindly, with none of the smirking speculation I occasionally surprised on the faces of the other soldiers. If I had been inclined to offer up bedtime prayers, I would have included his name therein. I rose, dusted off my cloak, and went to my tent. Seeing me go, Corporal Rowbottom also rose, and, circling the fire discreetly, sat down by his comrades again, his back in direct line with the entrance to my tent. When the soldiers retired to their beds, I knew he would seek a spot at a respectful distance, but still within call of my resting place. He had done this for the past 3 nights, whether we slept in inn or field. 3 nights earlier, I had tried yet another escape. Captain Mannering was well aware that I travelled with him under compulsion, and while he didn't like being burdened with me, he was too conscientious a soldier to shirk the responsibility. I had 2 guards, who watched me closely, riding on each side by day. At night, the guard was relaxed, the captain evidently thinking it unlikely that I would strike out on foot over deserted moors in the dead of winter. The captain was correct. I had no interest in committing suicide. On the night in question, however, we had passed through a small village about 2 hours before we stopped for the night. Even on foot, I was sure I could backtrack and reach the village before dawn. The village boasted a small distillery from which wagons bearing loads of barrels departed for several towns in the surrounding region. I had seen the distiller's yard piled high with barrels, and thought I had a decent chance of hiding there and leaving with the first wagon. So, after the camp was quiet, and the soldiers lumped and snoring in their blankets round the fire, I had crept out of my own blanket, carefully laid near the edge of a willow grove, and made my way through the trailing fronds with no more sound than the rustle of the wind. Leaving the grove, I had thought it was the rustle of the wind behind me too, until a hand clamped down on my shoulder.
"Don't scream. You don't want the captain to know you're out without leave."
I didn't scream, only because all the breath had been startled out of me. The soldier, a tallish man called Jesse by his mates because of the trouble he took in combing out his yellow curls, smiled at me, and I smiled, a little uncertainly, back at him. His eyes dropped to my bosom. He sighed, raised his eyes to mine, and took a step toward me. I took 3 steps back, fast.
"It doesn't matter really, does it, sweetheart?"
he said, still smiling lazily.
"Not after what's happened already. What's once more, eh? And I'm an Englishman too," he coaxed, "not a filthy Scot." "Leave the poor woman alone, Jess,"
Corporal Rowbottom said, emerging silently from the screen of willows behind him.
"She's had enough trouble, poor lady."
He spoke softly enough, but Jesse glared at him, then, thinking better of whatever he'd had in mind, turned without another word and disappeared under the willow leaves. The corporal had waited, unspeaking, for me to gather up my fallen cloak, and then had followed me back to the camp. He had gone to pick up his own blanket, motioned me to lie down, and placed himself 6 feet away, sitting up with his blanket about his shoulders, Indian style. Whenever I woke during the night, I had seen him still sitting there, staring short-sightedly into the fire. Tavistock did have an inn.
I didn't have much time to enjoy its amenities, though. We arrived in the village at midday, and Captain Mannering set off at once to deliver up his current crop of dispatches. He returned within the hour, though, and told me to fetch my cloak. "Why?" I said, bewildered. "Where are we going?" He glanced at me indifferently and said,
"To Belhurst Manor."
"Right," I said. It sounded a trifle more impressive than my current surroundings, which featured several soldiers playing at chuck-a-luck on the floor, a flea-ridden mongrel asleep by the fire, and a strong smell of hops. The manor house, without regard to the natural beauty of its site, stubbornly turned its back on the open meadows and huddled inland instead, facing the stark cliffside. The drive was straight, short, and unadorned, unlike the lovely curving approaches to French manors, but the entrance was equipped with two utilitarian stone pillars, each bearing the heraldic device of the owner. I stared at it as my horse clopped past, trying to place it. A cat. Perhaps a leopard, couchant, with a lily in its paw. It was familiar, I knew. But whose? There was a stir in the long grass near the gate, and I caught a quick glimpse of pale blue eyes as a hunched bundle of rags scuttled into the shadows, away from the churn of the horse's hooves. Something about the ragged beggar seemed faintly familiar, too. Perhaps I was merely hallucinating, grasping at anything that didn't remind me of English soldiers. The escort waited in the dooryard, not bothering to dismount, while I mounted the steps with Captain Mannering, and waited while he hammered at the door, rather wondering what might be on the other side of it.
"Mrs. Beecham."
The butler, if that's what he was, looked rather as though he suspected the worst. No doubt he was right. "Yes," I said. "Whose house is this?" But even as I asked, I raised my eyes and looked into the gloom of the inner hall. A face stared back at me, doe eyes wide and startled. Mary Hawkins. As the girl opened her mouth, I opened mine as well, and screamed as loudly as I could. The butler, taken unprepared, took a step back, tripped on a settee, and fell over sideways like a bull's pin. I could hear the startled noises of the soldiers outside coming up the steps. I picked up my skirts, shrieked, "A mouse! A mouse!" and fled toward the parlour, yelling like a banshee. Infected by my apparent hysteria, Mary shrieked as well, and clutched me about the middle as I cannoned into her. I bore her back into the recesses of the parlour with me and grabbed her by the shoulders. "Don't tell anyone who I am," I breathed into her ear. "No one. My life depends on it." I thought I was being melodramatic, but it occurred to me as I spoke the words that I could very well be telling the exact truth. Being married to Red Jamie Fraser was likely a dicey proposition. Mary had time only to nod in a dazed sort of way, when the door at the far side of the room opened and a man came in.
"Whatever is all this wretched noise, Mary?" he demanded.
A plump, contented-looking man. He had also the firm chin and tightly satisfied lips of the man who is contented because he generally gets his own way.
"Nothing, Papa," said Mary, stuttering in her nervousness. "Only a mouse."
The baronet squeezed his eyes shut and inhaled deeply, seeking patience. Having found a simulacrum of that state, he opened them and gazed at his offspring.
"Say it again, child," he ordered, "but straight. I'll not have you mumbling and blithering. Take a deep breath, steady yourself. Now, again."
Mary obeyed, inhaling till the laces of her bodice strained across the budding chest. Her fingers wound themselves in the silk brocade of her skirt, seeking support.
"It was a mouse, Papa. Mrs. Fr... this lady was frightened by a mouse."
Dismissing this attempt as barely satisfactory, the baronet stepped forward, examining me with interest.
"Oh?
And who might you be, madam?
Captain Mannering, arriving belatedly after the search for the mythical mouse, popped up at my elbow and introduced me, handing over the note of introduction from Colonel MacLeish.
So it seems His Grace is to be your host, madam, at least temporarily.
He handed the note to the waiting butler, and took the hat the latter had taken from the nearby rack.
I regret that our acquaintance should be so short, Mrs. Beecham. I was just leaving myself.
He glanced over his shoulder to a short stairway that branched off the hall. The butler, dignity restored, was already mounting it, grubby note reposing on a salver held before him.
I see Walmsley has gone to tell His Grace of your arrival. I must go, or I shall miss the post-coach. Adieu, Mrs. Beecham.
He turned to Mary, hanging back against the panelled wainscoting.
Goodbye, daughter. Do try to... Well...
The corners of his mouth turned up in what was meant to be a fatherly smile.
Goodbye, Mary.
Goodbye, Papa, she murmured, eyes on the ground.
I glanced from one to the other. What on earth was Mary Hawkins, of all people, doing here? Plainly she was staying at the house. I suppose the owner must be some connection of her family's.
Mrs. Beecham.
A small tubby footman was bowing at my elbow.
His Grace will see you now, madam.
Mary's hands clutched at my sleeve as I turned to follow the footman.
But,
she began. In my keyed-up state, I didn't think I could manage sufficient patience to hear her out. I smiled vaguely and patted her hand.
Yes, yes, I said. Don't worry. It'll be all right.
But it's my...
The footman bowed and pushed open a door at the end of the corridor. Light within fell on the richness of brocade and polished wood. The chair I could see to one side had a family crest embroidered on its back, a clearer version of the worn stone shield I had seen outside. A leopard couchant, holding in its paw a bunch of lilies. Or were they crocuses? Alarm bells rang in my mind as the chair's occupant rose, his shadow falling across the polished doorsill as he turned. Mary's final anguished word made it out, neck and neck, with the footman's announcement.
My godfather, she said.
His Grace the Duke of Sandringham, said the footman.
Mrs. Beecham, said the Duke,
his mouth dropping open in astonishment.
Well, I said weakly,
something like that.
The door of the drawing-room closed behind me, leaving me alone with His Grace. My last sight of Mary had been of her standing out in the hall, eyes like saucers, mouth opening and shutting silently like a goldfish. There were huge Chinese jars flanking the windows and inlaid tables under them. A bronze Venus posed coquettishly on the mantelpiece, companioned by a pair of gold-rimmed porcelain bowls, and silver gilt candelabra blazing with beeswax candles. A close-napped carpet that I recognised as a very good Kermanshaw covered most of the floor, and a spinet crouched in one corner. What little space was left bare was occupied by marquetried furniture and the odd piece of statuary.
"Nice place you have here," I remarked graciously to the Duke,
who had been standing before the fire, hands folded beneath his coat-tail, as he watched me, an expression of wary amusement on the broad, florid face.
"Thank you,"
he said, in the piping tenor that came so oddly from that barrel-chested frame.
"Your presence adorns it, my dear."
Amusement won out over wariness, and he smiled, a bluff, disarming grin.
"Why, Beecham," he asked, "that isn't by chance your real name, is it?"
"My maiden name,"
I answered, rattled into the truth. His thick blonde eyebrows shot up.
"Are you French?"
"No, English. I couldn't use Fraser, though, could I?"
"I see."
Brows still raised, he nodded at a small brocaded love seat, inviting me to be seated. It was richly carved and beautifully proportioned. A museum piece, like everything else in the room. I swept my sodden skirts to one side as gracefully as I could, ignoring their liberal stains of mud and horsehair, and delicately lowered myself onto the primrose satin. The Duke paced slowly back and forth before the fire, watching me, still with a slight smile on his features. I fought the growing warmth and comfort that spread through my aching legs, threatening to drag me into the abyss of fatigue that gaped open at my feet. This was no time to let down my guard.
"Which are you?" the Duke inquired suddenly. "An English hostage? A fervent Jacobite? Or a French agent?"
I rubbed two fingers over the ache between my eyes. The correct answer was, none of the above, but I didn't think it would get me very far.
"The hospitality of this house seems a trifle lacking by comparison with its appointments," I said, as haughtily as I could manage under the circumstances, which wasn't all that much. Still, Louise's example of great ladydom hadn't been entirely in vain.
The Duke laughed, a high, chittering sort of laugh, like a bat that has just heard a good one.
"Your pardon, madam. You're quite right. I should have thought to offer you refreshment before presuming to question you. Most thoughtless of me."
He murmured something to the footman, who appeared in answer to his ring, then waited calmly before the fire for the tray to arrive. I sat in silence, glancing around the room, occasionally stealing a look at my host. Neither of us was interested in making small talk. Despite his outward geniality, this was an armed truce, and both of us knew it. What I wanted to know was, why? No stranger to people wondering who in hell I was, I rather wondered myself where the Duke came into it, or where he thought I did. He had met me twice before, as Mrs. Fraser, wife of the Laird of Lallybroch. Now I had turned up on his doorstep, posing as an English hostage named Beecham, lately rescued from a gang of Scottish Jacobites. That was enough to make anyone wonder. But his attitude toward me went a long way past simple curiosity. The tea arrived, complete with scones and cake. The Duke picked up his own cup, motioned to mine with a lift of one brow, and we took tea, still both in silence. Somewhere, on the other side of the house, I could hear a muffled banging, as of someone hammering. The soft chime of the Duke's cup against its saucer was the signal for the resumption of hostilities.
"Now then," he said, with as much firmness as a man who sounded like Mickey Mouse could manage. "Let me begin, Mrs. Fraser. I may call you so, thank you. Let me begin by saying that I know a great deal about you already. I intend to know more. You will do well to answer me fully and without hesitations. I must say, Mrs. Fraser, that you are amazingly difficult to kill."
He bowed slightly in my direction, that smile still on his lips.
"But I feel sure that it could be accomplished, given sufficient determination."
I stared at him, unmoving, not out of any native sang-froid, but from simple dumbfoundedness. Adopting another of Louise's mannerisms, I raised both eyebrows inquiringly, sipped tea, then patted my lips delicately with a monogrammed serviette provided. "I'm afraid you will think me dense, Your Grace," I said politely, "but I haven't the faintest idea what you're talking about."
"Haven't you, my dear?"
The small, jolly blue eyes didn't blink. He reached for the silver gilt bell on the tray and rang it once. The man must have been waiting in the next room for the summons, for the door opened immediately. A tall, lean man in the dark habiliments and good linen of an upper servant advanced to the Duke's side and bowed deeply.
"Your Grace?"
He spoke English, but the French accent was unmistakable. The face was French, too, long-nosed and white, with thin, tight lips, and a pair of ears that stood out from his head like small wings on either side, their tips fiercely red. His lean face grew still paler as he looked up and spotted me, and he took an involuntary step backward.
Sandringham watched this with a frown of irritation, then switched his gaze to me. "You don't recognize him?" he asked.
I was beginning to shake my head when the man's right hand twitched suddenly against the cloth of his breeches. As unobtrusively as possible, he was making the sign of the horns, middle fingers folded down, index and little finger pointed at me. I knew then, and in the next instant had seen the confirmation of my knowledge, the small beauty mark above the fork of his thumb. I hadn't the slightest doubt. It was the man in the spotted shirt who had attacked me and Mary in Paris, and all too obviously in the Duke's employ. "You bloody bastard," I said. I leapt to my feet, overturning the tea table, and snatched up the nearest object to hand, a carved alabaster tobacco jar. I hurled it at the man's head, and he turned and fled precipitately, the heavy jar missing him by inches to smash against the door frame. The door slammed to as I started after him, and I stopped in my tracks, breathing heavily. I glared at Sandringham, hands braced on my hips. "Who is he?" I demanded. "My valet," said the Duke calmly. "Albert Danton by name. A good fellow with neckcloths and stockings, but a trifle excitable as so many of these Frenchmen are. Incredibly superstitious, too." He frowned disapprovingly at the closed door. "Bloody papists with all these saints and smells and such. Believe anything at all." My breathing was slowing, though my heart still banged against the whalebones of my bodice. I had trouble drawing a deep breath. "You filthy, disgusting, outrageous pervert!" The Duke seemed bored by this, and nodded negligently. "Yes, yes, my dear. All that, I'm sure, and more. A trifle unlucky, too, at least on that occasion." "Unlucky? Is that what you'd call it?" Unsteadily, I moved to the love seat and sat down. My hands were shaking with nerves, and I clasped them together, hidden in the folds of my skirt. "On several accounts, my dear lady. Just look at it." He spread out both hands in graceful entreaty. "I send Danton to dispose of you. He and his companions decide to entertain themselves a bit first. Well, that's all well and good, but in the process they get a good look at you, leap unaccountably to the conclusion that you're a witch of some kind, lose their heads entirely and run off. But not before debauching my goddaughter, who is present by accident, thus ruining all chance of the excellent marriage I had painstakingly arranged for her. Consider the irony of it." The shocks were coming thick and fast, and I hardly knew which to respond to first. There seemed one particularly striking statement in this speech, though. "What do you mean, dispose of me?" I demanded. "Do you mean to say you actually tried to have me killed?" The room seemed to be swaying a bit, and I took a deep gulp of tea as being the nearest thing to a restorative available. It wasn't terribly effective. "Well, yes," Sandringham said pleasantly. "That was the point I was endeavouring to make. Tell me, my dear, would you care for a cup of sherry?" I eyed him narrowly for a moment. Having just stated that he'd tried to have me killed, he now expected me to accept a cup of sherry from his hands. "Brandy," I said. "Lots of it." He giggled in that high-pitched way again, and made his way to the sideboard, remarking over his shoulder, "Captain Randall said you were a most diverting woman. Quite an encomium from the captain, you know. He hasn't much use for women ordinarily, though they swarm over him. His looks, I suppose. It can't be his manner." "So Jack Randall does work for you," I said, taking the glass he handed me. I had watched him pour out two glasses, and was sure that both contained nothing but brandy. I took a large and sorely needed swallow. The Duke matched me, blinking his eyes at the effect of the pungent liquid. "Of course," he said. "Often the best tool is the most dangerous. One doesn't hesitate to use it on that account. One merely makes sure to take adequate precautions."
"Dangerous, eh?
Just how much do you know about Jonathan Randall?" I asked curiously. The Duke tittered. "Oh, virtually everything, I should think, my dear. Most likely a great deal more than you do, in fact. It doesn't do to employ a man like that without having a means at hand to control him, you know.
And money is a good bridle, but a weak rein.
Unlike blackmail, I said dryly.
He sat back, hands clasped across